All right, welcome back to the Ugly Pike podcast. Frank, today on the show, we are super excited about the conversation we are going to have with an extremely dedicated and passionate professional muskie angler. His home waters are in Minnesota. He's been fishing muskie for over 20 years. He won his first muskie tournament at 12 and continued fishing competitively, eventually becoming the professional muskie tournament trail world champion and also being named top gun of the year. He's a professional guide, accomplished writer, sought-after speaker, educator, content provider, co-founder of the Muskie Insider publication, and the list goes on. So we're super happy to have him with us today. Our schedule is finally aligned. Mr. Josh Borofsky, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for taking the time to do this with us today.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited.
Cool.
So are we.
I'm super excited because Josh was in one of my favorite Linder's Angling Edge episodes where you guys are targeting early season muskies in open water. I love that episode. I've got it recorded. I watch it all the time. I watched it today.
Cool.
Yeah. Chris, I don't want to jump in and hijack, so where would you like to start today?
Well, let's talk a bit about your home waters, Josh. I mean, you grew up muskie fishing in Minnesota. Can you talk to us? I'm gonna ask you after this a bit about your passion. I mean, how you came addicted to all this, but your home waters, I mean, where do you most commonly guide out of? And, you know, how is the muskie populations, the health of the muskie populations in those lakes right now? And we both, Frank and I, watched that video of Mille Lacs that you just recently published, and I thought that was very interesting and kind of related to this question. So can you elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. So there's layers to the question. So I guess I'll just start with, where I'm currently guiding is, I live in the metro area, at least most of the year, but I guess you could almost argue that I live on Lake Vermilion for the summer months. And kind of the way I do my guiding is we have a whole bunch of lakes in the metro area here. The biggest one though is Minnetonka. It's about 12,000 acres and I do the lion's share of my metro guiding there. So I usually just do a couple weeks, in the metro to start out the season. And then I head north to Lake Vermilion to take advantage of that suspended bite that you were talking about earlier that you saw in the video. That's where we were when we filmed that piece. And then I'm usually stay on Lake Vermilion for pretty much the entire summer till the middle of August. And part of the reason I do that is just one, I love Lake Vermilion. It's beautiful. You know, there's 365 islands on the lake and lots of giant fish. But also it's far enough north and big enough water that, you know, most seasons we don't really have to worry or deal with like the water temperatures being too hot to fish. Last year we actually did have to deal with that for a while. But usually we don't. And then, you know, once we usually get to late August, you know, we start having the cooler nights and the shorter days and the metro area temperatures, you know, start to cool and come into the safety zone. And so I head back to be closer to my family, and guide in the metro through like mid October. And then, I just can't resist going back to Vermilion when the tulipy and whitefish are spawning up there. So I'm usually up there from the end of October through about the third week of November, if we can make it that far. I usually book it about that far, but usually it kind of ices up on us somewhere between that second and third week of November. And then I come back and finish up in the metro till December 1st. So that's kind of my typical schedule. I have been, rotating in some lake X's. I do a lot of research. I keep track of stocking on all the lakes and also kind of, you know, study, Google Earth maps and stuff and look for, you know, there's definitely quite a few fisheries in Minnesota right now that are kind of lake X's where they're not stocked or managed for muskies, but because they're connected to waters that have populations, you know, we call them swim down lakes. There's fishable populations. So I do sneak away to those lakes periodically during the season and take some of my regular customers to those as well. So that's kind of my breakdown of how I'm spending my time. And as far as, the status of like the muskie populations and the fishery in general in Minnesota, It's hard to talk about, right? Because I'm a guide, right? I want you to come fishing with me, but I'm also, you know, if I'm being honest, you know, on the vast majority of our waters, the good old days are pretty far behind us right now. You know, and some of the lakes are like coming back. I mean, it's not like the fishing is terrible on a lot of them, but compared to what it once was, it's just not, you know what I mean? Not the same. And Mille Lacs is definitely, you know, probably the worst case scenario, where there was a time when, you know, and I'm realizing when I posted that video, by the way, about Mille Lacs on my YouTube channel, like I got a lot of response to it, in comments and stuff, but also just people reaching out to me. And I realized like how there's kind of a whole new generation of muskie fishing anglers that don't even really recognize or understand like how good the fishing once was there. Mm. I mean, there was a time when I think you could legitimately argue that was the best muskie fishery on earth. Like, I mean, it was crazy good. There were, I mean, I know, you know, somebody I know had a, you know, a 19 fish day out there with 7 fish over 50 inches in one day. Right. Like that's what it was at one point, you know, and, you know, it kind of went from that. So if you watch that video, you can see, you know, there's still really, really big fish in that lake. You know, maybe you could even argue they're bigger now just because there's so few of them. But, you know, it's definitely, you know, fallen off and kind of a needle in a haystack. You're definitely going to have to take your lumps on that body of water. You know, if you want to go out and try and catch one, you're going to have to deal with a bunch of skunks to accomplish it. And in the grander scheme of Minnesota and our fisheries, you know, and this is just my opinion, like I'm not a scientist. I'm also willing to admit that I could be wrong. Okay. But just the way I see it, and I'm probably going to make some more of those videos and try and just tell the whole story of what happened in Minnesota, because I'm realizing just a lot of people don't understand like the numbers behind all of this. But in my opinion, we kind of had I don't want to say a statewide crash, but kind of that's like the word that comes to mind. Like it started with Mille Lacs, and you know, that's a huge body of water. You know, it's over 100,000 acres and swallowed up a lot. You know, there's a whole just army of like probably thousands of muskie anglers that were fishing there on any given day. Right. And so when it tailed off and just took a huge dive, I mean, it got so bad, like almost all the guides who were there had to leave the lake and go somewhere else and take all their clientele with them. Right. And even people who are just fishing on their own, at some point, you know, when you go so many days without even seeing a fish, you decide to go somewhere else. And then what that did is it basically created, you know, some extreme fishing pressure on, you know, like I was on Lake Vermilion. I wasn't on Mille Lacs kind of when that crash happened, but I felt it on Vermilion because the fishing pressure there probably like quadrupled from all the boats that, you know, that used to fish Mille Lacs coming there. And then because, you know, a lot of the other Minnesota bodies of water that were bigger were stocked in a, not exactly the same, but similar fashion to Mille Lacs. When you added that extra pressure and delayed mortality, from all the fishing pressure, they started to, experience similar issues. And then, you know, once the big waters kind of start to tail off, then, you know, everyone eventually just filters until everything's been hit. And so I feel like, you know, that's about the shortest way that I can explain kind of a very complex, you know, thing that happened. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, it was a great answer. So, you know, you showed in that video, there was like a correlation between the stocking drop and the fishing drop. Are they continuing to stock now today as we speak, or is that stopped completely?
They're still stocking, but you know, they basically, it's 120,000 acres roughly. Don't have like the numbers in front of me, so I always get like a little, you know, I don't like throwing numbers around unless I have the exact ones in front of me. But I can tell you that it gets like 3,000 fish every other year is kind of like the plan that it gets now. But keep in mind, like on that plan, like basically, so in the last 10 years, you know, Mille Lacs is, that gives it what, like 9,000 fish or whatever. I know basically, and I kind of talked about it in that video, there were years during the good years of stocking where just one year of stocking back then equals like the last 10 years of stocking that it's got, you know, since then. And this puts it in perspective more, is there are lakes in Minnesota right now that are 3,000 acres, okay, versus 120,000 acres, and they get 3,000 fish every other year.
Whoa.
Versus, you know what I mean? So they get the same stocking that 120,000 acre lake gets. So it's really, it's just such a small amount. I mean, it's almost like it doesn't even count. So, man, in my opinion.
That's definitely a tough spot, Chris. I mean, you know, Josh, you're a guide. Yeah. And, but you want to be honest and you want to call attention to the problems, and maybe, you know, rally the troops and get some solutions. And I know we're having some of the same issues here, particularly on the St. Lawrence, which is, you know, one of our greatest musky waterways, here in Canada, Canadian, U.S. border. And, you know, they're having a problem with fish regenerating. We don't stock the St. Lawrence, obviously, but natural reproduction rates are falling. And, you know, you hearken back to the golden era of fishing. And I think a lot of the older anglers will remember that era on the St. Lawrence. And today, I just think a lot of, like you said, Josh, a lot of musky anglers today don't really have a sense of what that was like. Chris, I know I don't. I mean, you and I have had good days and good lakes here and there, but we don't have a sense of those golden days. And so we know what we're signing up for. We're here for the grind, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be calling attention to it and trying to get some of the best, you know, scientists and biologists and anglers and reporting on deck to try and remedy some of these issues that we're having.
Agreed.
Yeah,
the best thing we can do is bring attention to it, right?
That's what I'm trying to do.
Exactly.
Okay, Josh, let's switch gears a little bit. You know, we talk, and this kind of leads into your kind of lifelong passion here. We talk a lot about on this podcast about, I guess we can call it obsession, addiction to this, you know, hunting muskie, the species of muskie. And there seems to be a moment when I guess you realize why, or you get it, why we're doing this, and you know, everything kind of changes and you start to really cherish those moments you have fishing muskie and when you catch one, as opposed to, you know, forgetting them. And can you speak to us about how this kind of developed in your life and how it kind of translated into a lifelong passion, and how that's kind of like all your skills and talents that you have are now kind of being used to help people, educate people in musky fishing, and you're sharing that passion with them. And is there like a special moment where that just kind of clicked for you? Like a lot of people can kind of go to one moment.
Kinda. I mean, there's definitely the spark that lit the fire. And then I would say there's a different moment when like it just like the fire just turned into, you know, a blaze of just like complete obsession. Right. And so for me, you know, I caught my first muskie when I was a little kid. I want to say I was like 7 or something like that. And we had our family had a cabin in northern Wisconsin on the East Fork of the Chippewa River. And so, you know, I got exposed pretty early. I remember even before I caught that one, you know, just we had a bunch of families that would get together in the cabins and we'd have campfires at night and hearing stories about muskies, you know, like with the dads talking, right, was like hearing stories about the Loch Ness Monster. And I was just fascinated. You know, I remember like one of the really cool, like where I was like, wow, this is, you know, these fish are big and this is so cool, was we were fishing in a canoe at my cabin. And I think I had already caught my first one. I mean, I was kind of all in already, but, one of the kids that was, the parents let us go. The oldest kid was like 15. I was probably like 10. And the other kid was like in between us in age. And we were just fishing, you know, we were fishing for whatever would bite. We're fishing for walleyes and rock bass and stuff at the time in this little hole. And one of the kids caught a big smallie. And, you know, obviously I probably wouldn't obviously think about doing this today, but back when we were kids, you know, he wanted to put it on the stringer and bring it home and show his parents. And, you know, it was the biggest smallmouth he had caught. And it was a pretty good size one. And so he put it on the stringer on the canoe. And anyway, you probably can tell where the story's going.
Yeah, of course.
The boat comes motoring down, right? And he wants to show off his smallmouth. So he starts tugging on the stringer and it won't come up, right? And we look down and there's this giant muskie like latched onto the thing. And, you know, it wouldn't let go either for like the longest time. And it finally did. And then, you know, he ended up coming back and grabbing it again a second time. And then it actually ate, like tried to eat a rock bass that one of the other kids was reeling in. And then we were all fired up, right? And went back and like told the dads. And then the dads all got their musky gear and marched down to their boats, right? To go try to slay the dragon. And, you know, and came back with their tail between their legs. I think one of them ended up losing it. But anyway, you know, I was kind of all in as a kid, but I was limited to our trips to the cabin. And once I got out of high school and graduated from college and got my first job kind of right out of the gate. And I had this job where I worked at an elementary school. I was like a daycare director for a before and after school program. And once I had that job, first thing I bought was, you know, a boat and a truck to pull it. Right. Mm. And once I had those two things, like as soon as I had them, I just had this revelation, like, you know, like if I wanted to go fishing every day, like there's nothing stopping me. Like I could go every single day. And so I did, you know what I mean? I just would come to work with my boat hooked up. I had this like weird schedule where I had like a 3.5 hour lunch break in the middle of the day. And so I'd park in front of the school by the secretary's office so my stuff wouldn't, you know, get snatched, and, you know, work with the kids in the morning. And then I'd race over to, you know, there were a couple lakes that were, you know, pretty close to the school that I worked at. I'd eat my lunch in the truck on the way there. And I could get in like a good, like 3 hour session in the middle of the day. And then I would come back to school, work the rest of my shift till like 6 PM. And then I would just go back to the lake again and night fish and repeat. And I no joke, man, there was probably like a 30 day stretch at times where I just never even unhooked my boat from my truck. It just stayed attached because, you know what I mean? That was the deal. And, you know, and that was when I really started, you know, definitely refining and getting a lot better. And I was always a really big log keeper, which really helped me a lot too. And that actually goes back to when I was like 10 or 12 years old. You know, I was fortunate enough that my dad had bought Tony Rizzo's Secret of a Muskie Guide book when it came out. And that was like my little Bible when I was a kid. We would get to the cabin and I would, you know, like literally run out of the car into the cabin. We had a little, just a clip on thermometer that you could clip on the end of your leader. And I would run down to the shore of the lake, you know, cast it in, reel it in, check the temperature. And then I'd run back up to the Tony Rizzo book and turn to the chapter because he had it broken down by water temperature and be like, "Hey dad, Tony Rizzo says we should do this," you know? And my dad would be like, yeah, let's unpack the car first. Yeah. So
that's so cool, Josh. Like I have a similar, like my interest was piqued in muskie in very much a similar fashion because my father used to take me up to Lake Nipissing all the time. We'd go fishing and him and whoever else of his buddies or whether it was my grandfather, whoever, they would talk about muskies like they were these phantom dragons. And if you ever saw one, oh my God. And you know, it just put such a cool mystique onto the fish. And then of course, when you actually do see one yourself or you end up getting one to bite by accident or on purpose, for a lot of us, it changed our lives. And so it was really cool to hear that. And it's just something about this fish. I did the same thing. I took a job at an engineering firm about 8 years ago and they shipped me up for long periods of time to a town called Sudbury in Ontario. And we had a hotel right next to the office, but I opted to stay at a fishing lodge on the French River, 45 minutes down the road. And just like you said, Josh, you know, when 4 o'clock came, I would be like flying down that highway and into the boat at the end of the day and spending the evening on the river there because, you know, frankly, there's no place I'd rather be. So I think when the musky bug hits you, it's just a lot of us it just changed us.
For sure. It's like when you really get into it, you know, it's not really something you do. It's like, it's kind of almost like a way of life and it's like in you, it's like in your soul. It's just like part of who you are.
Absolutely. Well said.
And that's why you do it on your own, right? Like you get up and you do these things all day by yourself and most of your friends think you're crazy, But in your body, in your mind, you're like, well, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to get up and go to the water and fish. And, you know, you try bringing a friend with you, and a couple hours later, like, what are you doing, man? We got to go home or this. And then they'll never come back with you unless they catch the bug with you, because you're going to be there all day or any spare moment you get, especially when you're young and you have all this free time. So I find when you're doing these things on your own, like you're just driven to do it. You know, it's a true passion.
Yeah. And, you know, and you just love being out there regardless of the outcome. You made me giggle, cause I was thinking of a few times I brought friends with who, you know, weren't that into it. Right. And it turned out it was a tough day and not good conditions, and the fish weren't moving. And, you know, we'd be like quite a few hours in and just nothing had happened. And I just say something like, man, I love musky fishing. And they'd look at me like, dude, what are you talking about? Like, we haven't seen anything all day. And I'm like, yeah, but at least we know they're not biting, because otherwise I would just be like somewhere wondering if they were, you know what I mean? At least we know we're out here.
Yeah. It's tough to get that perspective. Josh, I brought my cousin to Eagle Lake, and that's far from where we sit. It's far from where you sit. It's far from where we sit. It's an airplane ride. And he had never really fished for muskie, but he was an angler his whole life. And I think he thought he realized what muskie fishing might be like. But after that first day when we got skunked, he pretty much fished for walleye for the rest of the trip. So not for everybody, but we do our best, I think, to get our buddies hooked on it and try to get people addicted to the feeling of musky fishing. But like you said, Josh, there's so much to be appreciated outside of the catch, and for guys like yourself and Chris and myself, just the fact that we're out there accumulating data, even if it's relative to our failure for that day, we see it as vital and as extremely valuable and as entertaining and fun even, right?
Right. And one little tip that I would give to your listeners too is something that helped me a lot early on with my fishing log bookkeeping was basically – you know, on the days that nothing happens and you really like did poorly, a lot of times there's not anything to enter in your fishing log. And I made it a point where I had a question, you know, at the end of my log entry that was basically like, hey, if you were faced with these exact same conditions on this lake again at the same time of year next time, what would you like? Obviously, what you just did not work. So where would you start? What would you do differently next time? And I mean, I just remember sometimes I was so angry at myself, you know, like for what I did do, and I'd write in giant letters, like scribbling, like, don't do this, you know, do this. And, you know, and then the next time you're faced with those conditions, you kind of eliminated some things, and instead of, you know, just falling back into a rut and just doing the same things you always do that didn't work.
Hear, hear.
That's a great tip. Josh, so when you were talking about like how enthusiastic and how you're, you know, just out there fishing as much as you could, and then obviously, you know, you talked about fishing in a tournament at 12 years old and winning one. So that led into this kind of competitive aspect of musky angling. And I often ask guys like you or people we've had on the podcast who are, you know, competed professionally, how has that kind of affected your knowledge and success as a musky angler today? And you know, what kind of takeaways would you advise or tips that would help like the average, you know, everyday musky angler from your competitive fishing?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, definitely you become better. Like you learn so much in tournaments, because no matter how tough the bite was, there was always like some people that caught fish. Right. And so, you know, if you go to the weigh-ins or, you know, the award ceremonies and people share what they did. You know, I learned a lot from that, you know, I mean, I'll never forget like very early on. You know, now it's just like, I did a class the other night and people asked me about tough day conditions. And part of my answer to that just comes from tournament experience. But, you know, like a lot of times if you have a flat bluebird sunny day, like, you know, rubber is going to shine. And obviously I've known that and fished that way for like a long time, but the lesson got learned in tournaments long ago on a super tough bite when maybe out of like 150 boats, there was only 5 boats that caught fish, but all of them were caught on bulldogs. Right. So you remember that sting of like, you know, not figuring it out and someone else did. And it kind of helps you helps you kind of, you know, it sinks in a little bit more. So you definitely learn a lot. I also would say that one way that it has helped me tremendously is, especially in recent years, especially like just with last year, you know, on Vermilion, the fishing pressure was insanely high just because of the border being closed. And, you know, just the way Lake Vermilion is it's probably one of the only lakes where you can truly kind of feel like you're in Canada and not be, and you're still in Minnesota. Just with the you know, that just the layout of the lake and the structure, and, you know, it's basically a Canadian shield lake. So between that there, and then obviously, you know, the other part of the season I'm guiding on the metro area lakes, which are also have a lot of high, you know, fishing pressure, and tournament fishing is basically like a huge crash course in dealing with fishing pressure. 'Cause there's, you know, everything's covered, you know, all the spots are covered, every depth is covered. And, you know, you definitely have to adapt to that, and you kind of learn some things to, you know, to do to deal with it, that definitely have paid dividends when I'm dealing with fishing pressure when I'm guiding.
Hey, Josh.
Frank, just quickly. I would imagine, Josh, that like under the pressure, you have to have confidence in your decisions, and you can't second guess yourself because there's just no time to do that. So once you make a decision, you got to be all in.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I will just say that the belief that you're going to do well and catch fish is probably one of the most like just overlooked and important things. And I've been lucky enough to actually have a couple tournament wins where we were literally the only boat out of the entire field to catch fish. I always personally, I pray for like a tough bite when we have tournaments because I'm a pretty adaptable fisherman. But when we've caught those fish, it hasn't always been on plan A, right? Like sometimes it's figuring out that what you're doing, like when to switch tactics and knowing that this isn't going to work. But I have a whole process to kind of how I figure that out. And I'm pretty disciplined in it. It just works for me and, you know, and helps me stay consistent. So I stick to it, and I got sidetracked. I forgot about what was the other part of your question that you asked? Oh, the belief. I was going to talk about the belief. So anyway, like in those tournaments where we were the only boat out of everybody to catch fish, like I don't even necessarily like think we had anything more figured out than anybody else. And you could argue that we got lucky, but I would almost argue that I think maybe we just believed that we were going to catch one a little bit more than everybody else. And so we did.
Cool. I got to ask, Chris, if you don't mind. Josh, you said
go ahead.
You said rubber shines, Josh.
Yep.
Can you just, for the listeners, I'm going to pretend like I'm cool and I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, but can you just go into like what you meant by that?
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, and don't get me wrong, like I don't just limit myself to rubber, but I mean, flat sunny days and rubber go together like bacon and eggs, man. Like they really are good baits that produce bites in tough conditions, especially when it's flat and sunny like that. I've just seen it time and time again. And so honestly, in tournaments and really, I probably transfer this to guiding all the time. You know, and we initially called the rule the bulldog just because back in the day, the bulldog was the only, you know, rubber bait we really had that we had confidence in. Now you could insert, you know, Medusa, hardhead, whale tail, you know, all the others, right? Like just a good rubber bait, right, in there. But we called it the bulldog rule. And basically the bulldog rule in tournaments was if you're sucking, one guy in the boat has to weld a bulldog to his rod and he does not take it off the entire day except to maybe change sizes or colors of bulldog. That's it, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other guy can like, you know, try to empty out the tackle box, finding the answer, but you leave that bulldog in there and you never take it off. And part of it was just because of, like I said, being in tournaments, like, you know, you see it happen a bunch of times where when it's tough conditions, it's like the vast majority, if not all the fish get caught that way. And don't get me wrong. There's all kinds of nuances and idiosyncrasies. I've seen it be other things, other baits, making contact with structure, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not 100%, but I mean, it's definitely something I'm going to lean on in a good, I think just a generally a good rule you know, to follow. And if you got more than one person, I'm not saying necessarily that every person in the boat throws it, but I would certainly have at least one person throwing.
Yeah, that's really cool, because that probably the, maybe not the longest, but definitely the biggest in terms of girth and weight and size, biggest fish I caught was last season. Sunny day, slow day, and I was the guy throwing the rubber. So a very cool tip. I was throwing a Shadzilla, and it was slow, and I landed a monster that day. And you know what? Maybe that was why. So very validating. Very cool. Awesome. Great tip.
Thanks.
Okay, that's a great segue, Josh, because you started touching on some of the decisions you're making there on the fly or based on the conditions. So bear with me for a sec. I want to get your thoughts on this. So when we're planning our day for a day on the water for muskie or our upcoming trip, we know there's this kind of infinite number of decisions that we'll make, both kind of before we get on the water, when we're on the water, obviously, you know, all the major things like weather, tackle, what lake we're going to, what spots we're going to, what depth we're going to target, casting, trolling, time of day, all of that stuff. In our pre-discussion and the emails, you made this really interesting comment about all these decisions that you make are either hurting you or helping you catch muskie, and there's very little kind of wiggle room in between. Can you explain what you mean by that and kind of how that applies in your kind of day-to-day muskie fishing? Because I think it's really interesting how you frame that, kind of hurting and helping.
I love that quote too, Chris. I'm glad you asked that.
Sure. So, I'll just mention it now. I mean, I'll give you as thorough of an answer as I can, you know, with time constraints, right? Because I can tell you that actually, next week I will basically be doing an entire class, like a virtual class just on basically that stuff, right? Like what I call my system. I have a whole process to kind of how I break down the water. And so to try and answer it in one question, I could be sitting here talking for 2 hours and I still would have an hour left of stuff I didn't cover, but I can definitely hit on some key points. And I will add that, you know, I mean, basically what I meant with that quote is, I mean, there's really only like anytime you make any decision out there on the water, there's really only three possible like outcomes that are going to happen, right? In terms of your fishing success, either your odds just got better of catching a fish, or they got worse, or they can remain unchanged too, right? Mm-hmm. But just from what I see out there, like day to day, like being out there all the time, is there's just really not that many things that leave like your odds like exactly like where they were. So, you know, which is crazy, because that just means like every single thing that you're doing, with your decision making, it's either like helping you go the right direction, or it's going the opposite and hurting you. There's just a lot of little things. Like, I mean, even like just here's one, like just even before you make your first cast, in my opinion, just like the side of the boat that you're fishing off of matters. And it's interesting because I did a class, just a few days ago, and I kind of talked about this in depth, just in one context of how it can affect your hook sets, but also your figure eights. But then even at the end of class, like some of the questions some of my students were asking, I kind of felt like, I don't think this sunk in. Like they're still not getting, because they're asking me about casting at all these weird angles. And my answer is I just wouldn't make those casts, you know? And I guess I should explain myself first. And so, if you guys got anything around you right now, maybe you got a glass of water, a beer, or fishing rod, whatever, whenever we hold on to any object, no matter what it is, there's always going to be a kind of a strong point and a weak point to your grip. And if you look at something, if you just grab anything and hold on to it, the seam between like your thumb and your fingers, if it's a larger circumference object, there'll actually be a gap where there's just space. If it's smaller, your hand might wrap all the way around it and touch your thumb. But still, wherever that seam is between your thumb and your fingertips, that's the weak part of the grip. And if someone tried to rip that object out of your hand, if they pulled in that direction, they would probably get it out if they pulled hard enough, right? That's just where your fingers and thumbs open up and it slides right out of your hand. Okay. And where the opposite side of that grip is your strong point, where basically if they pull that direction, they're just pulling it into your hand more and it's not going anywhere. And so that concept applies you know, when you're holding onto your fishing rod, it doesn't matter whether you hold the foregrip or palm the reel, you're still going to have a strong point and a weak point to that grip. And in my opinion, if you're somebody who reels with your right hand, like most of us are, if you're a lefty, it still applies, just everything reverses. But if you reel with your right hand, you know, you want to be fishing off the port side of the boat just because that strong point of your grip faces the fish. If you face off the opposite side, off a starboard side, the weak point of your grip faces the fish. And if you've ever been fishing muskies and you get rocked by a fish and it feels like you almost lost your rod or like it almost got pulled out of your hand and you didn't get a very good hook set, it was kind of awkward because of that. It was probably because of your positioning and you were either like fishing off that wrong side of the boat or you were standing, you know, casting and retrieving at a weird angle where that weak side of your grip was exposed to the fish. And so therefore you didn't catch it. Right. And so, so I like to, you know, if you fish off the port side, that strong side of your grip faces the fish. And even if you're not paying attention at all, when the fish hits, it basically pulls the rod into your hand instead of out of it. And then it pulls your hand away from your body, which is just perfect to come back, you know, across and set the hook. It also affects figure eights too, just the side of the boat that you fish off of. You know, generally, you know, if you're reel with your right hand, you want to do a nice left to right sweep. You know, to before you turn it away, you know, at the boat for the first turn of your figure eight. And, you know, if you're doing that same left to right sweep, fishing off the opposite side of the boat and the boat's moving at all, which a lot of times it is, as we work down the structure, that movement of the boat is actually slowing down your bait and your sweep when you want to be, you know, you want it to be accelerating. And so it'll make your turn a little less wide because of that. And it'll definitely slow you down, if the boat's moving at all, where if you're fishing off the correct side, the port side, that basically that movement of the boat is actually helping accelerate your bait. And so that's a perfect example, right? Of like one side, it's like actually hurting you and the other side, it's helping you. And there's not really any in between, you know? So maybe that's a good example. And, I know you asked just about the process too. You know, I'm trying to find a very simplified, explanation, you know, to that, but maybe I'll just start with, like kind of step one of my process, I guess, of breaking down the water would just be, I'll give you the first two things. Basically, my belief is you always want to use the best hooking percentage bait that you can get away with. You know, and when I explain this in my classes, I call it the cloned angler example, where if I could clone myself and there were two of me out there fishing, on the lake, right? And one clone of me had, you know, a really high hooking percentage bait, like a bucktail, and another clone version of a glider, or a walk the dog, something that was a poor hooker. And both those versions of me, you know, got the same number of bites over the course of the day. I'm calling that the one throwing the bucktail, right, would catch considerably more of the fish just because the hooking percentages are higher, right? And so that's why you always want to, you know, so the idea is to use the highest hooking percentage bait you can get away with. And then also when in terms of speed, with the cloned example, again, a lot of times I'll give people the example of trolling. There's Josh one out there trolling, you know, 2 miles an hour, and clone number two of Josh is going 4 miles an hour. And if the fish don't care about speed on that particular day and both Josh's get the same number of bites, or not even the same number of bites, let's just say they'll, because that could even change, because let's just say they like both presentations the same equally. They'll bite equally both. I'm calling the boat going 4 miles an hour will actually get twice as many bites. Because they're covering twice as much ground with their movement going twice as fast, right? The problem is on any given day, things are not equal, right? Like the fish might prefer the slower troll bait, or they might prefer the poor hooking glide bait, right? And so the question that I try to get answered, one of the first things when I come out of the chute every day on the water, is how fast can we get away with today? And how good of a hooking percentage bait we can get away with today. And there's a way to do that. You basically fish the baits in a certain order. And so if you when you're running your spots, if you have three people in the boat, which a lot of times I do, you know, and this is just something, by the way, I'm not just talking about this because it's cool and interesting or whatever. Like this is stuff that I'm super passionate about. And I realize how passionate I am about it, that it matters, because sometimes, like, if I fish when I'm not guiding with buddies or something, I get like, I don't have control of the ship anymore. And I get forced to like not fish this way. And it drives me nuts because I know it's costing us fish. Right. So basically what I'm saying is, you know, the person in the front of the boat is always going to have the fastest bait of the three and the best hooking bait. In the summer months, that's going to be a bucktail going fast. But this whole process can transfer to any time of year, right? In colder water, the fastest bait might be much slower in speed. But out of the three, the fastest bait and the best hooking bait will be the one in the front of the boat. And then the one in the middle will be the next fastest, right? And the next best hooking percentage bait. And then in the back of the boat will be the slowest, erratic, poorest hooking bait. And so because I have this system, like, I throw jerk baits probably 80% of the time all season long. Not because they're my favorite bait or anything else, but because that's kind of the system. And then you kind of allow the fish to tell you, like, you're presenting them to the fish, right? In a way where, hey, here's your first choice. Are you willing to eat this today? Right. And if they say yes, then you can start cheating that way and speeding everything up, and you can start shifting, you know, your progression of your baits that way. And, you know, and then sometimes it shifts the other way where the person in the back of the boat's getting bit and the front two people aren't moving any fish at all. And then that's the fish telling you today's a day we're going to have to more methodically, you know, pick things apart and fish slower. But it basically, it's a process that kind of answers those questions and tells you, you know, what you can get away with. And then from there, you know, there's, you know, like I said, it'd take me 3 hours to go and cover it all. Right. But there's a way to kind of, you know, figure out the type of structure, like, and pattern that and try to get it as dialed in as possible. And, you know, the colors of the baits and all of that stuff. But that's probably about as much time as I can dedicate to that answer with the podcast here.
I love that technical breakdown. Chris, I know you could listen to it all day. I could listen to it all day. The stuff on the grips, Josh, maybe you missed your calling. Maybe you should have been a jiu-jitsu teacher, because, you know, we teach about the gap, the grip gap, and exploiting that in breaking grips when your opponent grabs you and stuff. And with my kids and with my women, how to get out of a really strong, you know, wrist grip and stuff like that. So really cool to see those principles overlap. And, you know, I can tell you 100% that you're definitely onto something there. That was really, really some really cool information. Makes me want to get in my boat and just toss my rod around a little bit and play with my techniques and stuff like that. So really cool. Really cool. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I love the technical breakdown, Josh, and I love the passion behind how you're explaining it, because you believe in it. And I think that's what matters most, right? Like, there could be someone who has a completely opposite approach, but as long as you believe in it and you follow it, and like mentally, you know, that's going to lead to your success. I think that's what, you know, makes you so confident and boosts your confidence. So, yeah, I loved it. I loved how you broke that down. And, I'm, as Frank said, the minute I get on a boat, I'm going to be looking at, you know, enacting some of those tips you just gave us.
Yeah, thank you. And I will give you one caveat to everything I just told you to. So, like, a lot of these beliefs and systems I have is my kind of claim to fame, both in tournament fishing and in guiding, is I'm very consistent, right? I try to take pride in being the boat that gets bit every day, no matter what the conditions are. And that's part of why I pray for, like, those tough days in tournaments, right? Because I'm confident that, like, this process that I just explained will lead me to the answer, and I will figure it out before the day is over and I'll get bit, right? But what I told you is not necessarily the way, like, that's not necessarily the way to always be the person that catches the biggest fish or the most, mm-hmm. although it's led me to being that person quite a few times too, right? If you figure it out early enough, or like in a tournament, if you're fishing for multiple days using this process, you can refine the pattern, like, down way further than everybody else, right? But, you know, honestly, like, the person that catches the most is the one that guesses, right? Says today they're biting black and silver bucktails going really fast on shallow rocks. And they just decide that that's what the bite's going to be. And they guess right. And they come out of the chute, right? They're going to catch the most. Like, I'll still figure that out pretty quickly using my process over the course of the day. The problem is if you're that person and you're wrong, you're not going to catch anything. And I feel like a lot of times the way the majority of people fish is that's what they do. Like they make their guesses and they don't necessarily like use a process to it. And then eventually when they kind of figure out however many hours into the day that the thing that they chose maybe wasn't the right thing, they can backpedal and they can even then decide to do this process that I'm talking about, but they can't get back those 3, 4, 5, 6 hours that they weren't using the process, right? That like that data set of time has been lost. And so that's kind of the danger of like doing it that way.
That's so cool. That's probably the single biggest lesson I learned this season, Josh, because I fished with some great anglers, especially with regard to trolling, where there were systems in place, and you know, we were running trials and we were switching it up and we were changing depths, and watching these guys just go through their system was so impressive. And it took us a while to get dialed in. And then, you know, once we had a couple trips and a lot of hours on the lake, we ended the season in spectacular fashion because the systems were working excellently for us. So that was something that took me a lot of years to really understand and understand the value of, like, really.
Right. And it really stands out with trolling just because it's definitely more finite, right? It's like there's just some main recipes with speed, line lengths, depths, right? 100%. And it's just once you score with trolling, it's much more, I feel like it's easier to duplicate your success over and over again because it's just like a recipe and you just keep repeating the recipe and you keep scoring.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
100%. Cool.
All right. Where to next, Josh? I have a few things lined up here for you. We're talking about, you know, you're talking about some of these technical things now. Let's ask you a question about the figure eight process, because again, in our pre-discussion, you mentioned a few things about this, and this is something obviously not only on the podcast, every musky angler knows how valuable of a tool the figure eight is and how technical it can be and how much, you know, we've been recommending or been told to us by experts, you need to practice this. You need to put time in to get your figure eight technique down. You yourself have taught lectures that are 3 hours long just on this technique. So if I were to ask you, like, you know, today, give us one overriding principle or one tip that is going to be of most value to a listener on how to get their figure eight technique down, what would you say?
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll get to Josh's take on the figure eight. It's really cool. Chris and I have never heard anybody go on in so much depth of detail and so much nuance where the, you know, seemingly simple figure eight is concerned. We all know, most of us know, it's not that simple. After part two, we're going to realize that it's really not simple. Josh is a scientist on the water. He is a mathematician on the water. He's an incredible angler. And we hope that you guys really loved this first part as much as we did. Again, a wealth of knowledge, so much detail. So hope you enjoyed it, guys and girls. And part two is going to drop next couple weeks. Until then, take care and thanks for listening.